You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you proclaim the good news in your contexts. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker.
Today we're focusing on Genesis 37, 1 to 4 and 12 to 28, and Matthew 14, verses 22 to 33.
And joining us via Zoom from Perth, Australia, is Dr. Meg Warner. Meg is a tutor in Old Testament at Northern College Manchester, currently in Australia visiting, and also a research associate with the University of Exeter. She is author of numerous books and articles, and one of the things I really like about Meg's scholarship is that she writes both for the academy and for the church. And there's two recent books I want to mention. One is one she's edited called Tragedies and Christian Congregations: The Practical Theology of Trauma. And then her own book she's just written, which is just out, called Joseph, A Story of Resilience. Welcome, Meg.
Thanks, Robin. It's Fran, great to be with you.
It's great to have you here. So I'm going to kick off with the first question, Meg. I'm wondering what is it about the character of Joseph that drew you to write a book about him?
I think I just didn't understand him. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really odd story, and he does some very strange things. I never really got to know the musical Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat all that well, but I've been very much a Genesis person, and it was one of those things where several people asked me to write things about Joseph at once, and I thought, okay, let's get into him. And it turned out to be really rewarding.
Yeah, one of the sort of puzzling things really to do with the lectionary, which happens fairly frequently, is why we only hear of him twice in the lectionary. There's a whole, you know, most of his story we don't hear about.
No, that's true. I guess there's probably quite a bit of pressure on the lectionary in getting things in there, because there's quite a lot of biblical text. But there is a lot of Joseph's story. I'm just trying to think, 13 or 14 chapters.
Yeah.
It's really long. And Joseph is a bit of an enigma, actually. I mean, he gets all that space as much as Abraham, more than anyone else, really. But he never even makes it into the big three. So he's not an Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob character. And I think that's one of the reasons that I was fascinated by him. I was thinking, why has he got so much story and yet he never really cracks the big time?
And do you understand now why that's the case, having written the book?
I think I do. I think it's got a lot to do with politics. Surprise, surprise.
Like so much of the Bible.
Like so much of the Bible. But the rest of the Old Testament really winds up being the story of Judah, the southern kingdom, and not the story of Israel, the northern kingdom. Israel is really confusing because it means both the northern kingdom and Israel as a whole. But Joseph kind of stands for the northern kingdom, and he gets pipped at the post by Judah in this long story. And then the rest of the story after that tends to focus on Judah much more than it does on Israel, the north.
That's some really helpful context, not just for understanding what's going on in Genesis, because obviously written much later, but looking back.
Yes, that's right.
But for understanding so many of the other dynamics that we encounter in the Hebrew Bible. So here in chapter 37, we kind of encounter Joseph for the first time, introduced as the favourite son, the son of his old age, of Jacob. And we've been journeying now through the lectionary with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It seems to me that preachers might need to do some storytelling between this week and next week to fill in some of the gaps that the lectionary overlooks.
So this week sets up the story, and then next week kind of sort of ties it up in a bow.
Yes.
And
we've missed most of it.
No idea what's happened in between.
Yep. But in this story, in this section of 37 we have where he's introduced, what to you is, I guess let's start with getting into the nitty-gritty. What's exegetically interesting? Are there any themes or words or, you know, things we really need to notice as preachers?
What an interesting question. I think we need to notice Jacob's favoritism of Joseph and wonder what impact that might have for the rest of the story. Because Jacob starts out, he gives Joseph a special robe and he seems to send Joseph on tasks to spy on his brothers. Now, this has got to set up a bit of a problem. So much of Genesis is about tension between brothers. Sometimes it's about tension between sisters, but usually brothers. And Joseph is sort of set off on his own against all of the other brothers right at the beginning of the story. So what's the impact of Jacob's favoritism? What kind of a lad is Joseph? And your immediate answer is probably going to be he is a terror. He is completely full of himself. And you need to notice his dreams because they become a really important framework for the rest of the story. The dreams that he has at the beginning of the story where he imagines his entire family bowing down in front of him. And you can put yourself in the place of the older brothers thinking, you know, what would that do to them, this idea that their almost youngest brother is having dreams and not being bright enough to keep them to himself.
It's pretty tone deaf.
Telling his brothers about these dreams.
Yeah. And it seems to me that dreams here suddenly take on a different nature. We've had previous nighttime dreams and things with Jacob or visions, things that have been blurry, but these and then the ones that Joseph will go on and interpret are almost like prophetic foretelling in a very narrow sense of prophetic, but foretelling, foreboding dreams.
But they don't.
They are actually much more than you normally get with dreams or prophetic stuff in the Old Testament. But I think there's a real question mark over Joseph's dreams here. Later on in the story, he absolutely tells other people's dreams and he gets them right, and exactly what he says is going to happen happens. But in chapter 37, you don't have anything to use to measure Joseph's dreams and whether it's just him being full of himself or whether this is actually these dreams are from God and whether he's right about them. And God doesn't really get mentioned. God's kind of off in the background somewhere. So this is a bit of a mystery for us at the beginning. What kind of a guy is Joseph? And are these dreams real and true? And you don't get any way of measuring that until he starts reading other people's dreams, but really until right at the end of the story where you don't know whether they're going to wind up bowing down to him or not.
Yeah.
Even then, it's not quite clear because they do bow down to him, but not all of them. His mother is missing. So there remains a little bit of ambiguity about whether Joseph is having God-giving dreams or he's just a bit full of himself.
There's a point at which it's he sees the ambivalence too, because he says, doesn't he, interpreting dreams is for God and I shouldn't be doing it, but then he goes ahead and does it.
Yes, absolutely. He is one of the worst pietists I've encountered. He is full of very pious sayings about God and leave it to God and that's for God, but then he goes on and does exactly the thing that he says he wants to leave to God. So this is another of the reasons why you can't really trust him.
Yeah. And we've seen in these narratives, we've had the tricksters and the slightly underhanded, deceptive ways that people somehow end up doing God's work. Genesis is a complex set of stories in that sense.
Certainly is.
God continues to do God's work despite or through these human frailties and manipulations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that makes it, I think, a much more useful book for us today than it would be if all the characters were really well behaved and got it right all the time, because we can relate to them.
Absolutely, yeah.
We play tricks on people and we get it wrong, and yet God steps in at every point and redeems it and carries the story forward.
And we're also the master of rationalism as well, as in we will rationalise our own behaviour in ways that Joseph does, you know, justify ourselves.
Yes,
we will.
I was going to ask, this might be going a bit too far into the passage, Robin, straight to verse 19, but here comes this dreamer, his brothers say, and somewhere something I was reading suggested that the Hebrew actually is the Lord of Dreams.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that's right from memory.
Which is maybe has a tone of irony about it, given the sort of ambivalence and ambiguity you've been talking about.
Yes, I think so. It's definitely a sense of irony about it. They do not like him.
No.
And that, which leads me to other final thing that's really important. Well, maybe one of two final things that's really important to notice about this passage. The fact that the story begins with Joseph's brothers betraying him.
Yeah.
They sell him off to a group of traders, and there's a lot of really nice ambiguity about who these traders are that we could get into if you want to. But the first thing that happens to him in the story is that his brothers sell him take all his clothes off, throw him into a pit, sell him into slavery in Egypt. And as horrible, as unpleasant a guy as Joseph appears to be, he can't deserve that.
No.
That's how the story starts.
Can you talk a bit through the ambiguity of those where he's been sold into, just briefly, those groups?
So there are a couple of things going on. One is that different brothers have different plans. Reuben seems to want to Reuben is the eldest son. Reuben seems to want to curry favor with his father by rescuing Joseph and taking him back. Judah chimes in and says, "Oh, look, he's our brother, so we shouldn't kill him. We should just sell him." So that's one kind of brotherly love. Good on you, Judah. Nice work.
Yeah.
And somehow in between all of that, the brothers wind up sitting, having their lunch and not noticing what's going on, which is that a group of traders come and pull Joseph out of the pit. Now, there's a group of Ishmaelite traders and a group of Midianite traders. And if you happen to be fans of Rev, the BBC program.
Very much, yes.
There is a fantastic scene with a Bible quiz, and Nigel, who is Adam Smallbone's reader or LLM and is every bit as objectionable as Joseph, gets every question right until it comes to the question of who were the traitors who stole Joseph. So that's worth going back to look at, because it's quite fun. But the different groups of traitors have got to do with different strands of the story which were going on. So I was saying earlier that Judah had kind of taken over. So one of these groups of traders sort of belongs to the Judah taking over story, and another group of traders belongs to the earlier version of the story in which Joseph emerged triumphant from this whole experience. Mm.
You're listening to Dr. Meg Warner joining us here on By the Well. Meg, there's so much we could unpack here, but if you were preaching on this text for what's going on in the world and everything happening today, what themes, I mean, you've already touched on some. There's favoritism, there's sibling rivalry, there's God redeeming and having a plan despite our human terrible behaviour. Are there particular themes you'd draw out or theological points you'd want to get to in a sermon on Genesis 37?
Yeah, I think that because of some of the background that I've done in trauma studies and trauma theory, and because of the current situation in which we find ourselves, I would be picking up on the trauma that Joseph experiences at the hands of his brothers and starting to perhaps I'd be starting to prepare the ground for next week as well, and forecasting some of the story and some of the ways in which Joseph's behaviour seems to be shaped by his experience of being trafficked and enslaved by his brothers. Maybe if you're in Victoria, in Melbourne in particular, at the moment, you might be feeling betrayed by certain people or certain sectors of the community who, by failing to respect social distancing, means that you are locked up, or that if you are currently living in one of the towers, that you've been through an extraordinary experience of lockdown as a result of what some people did.
Mm.
So that might be a way in, but then to talk, be able to talk about some of the impact of trauma and how that works and where we look to God in terms of working in the context of that trauma.
Yeah, and Joseph will, of course, I mean, in some ways he redeems himself a bit later on by remaining faithful in the context of some sort of cultural or religious tests, I guess, or differences. It occurs to me too that in the global context, I mean, of course, the text here in some ways is pointing us towards this is how the whole of Israel will end up in slavery to Egypt eventually. So we're heading in that direction and into Exodus.
Yes.
And, you know, I think so many of us can naively think, well, slavery doesn't exist anymore because we don't have quite the same type of slavery. But people who work in this area will say there are more trafficked people on the planet now than ever before, and more people in sort of economic slavery. So, you know, it occurs to me another route on a sort of social justice level would be, you know, here in this ancient text, we have an incredibly, unfortunately, common human story of someone who is trafficked and will face sexual abuse and a whole lot of other things along the way.
So part of that's looking at how we deceive ourselves to protect our own privilege too.
Yeah.
Which I think does get into those issues, especially of race and colonialism.
And it's also got to do with trauma reaction, because a number of the things that Joseph does, and we tend to think of Joseph as being wise and righteous. That seems to be the general picture of him we get as a character. If Abraham is the towering figure of faith, then Joseph is wise and righteous. But in fact, Joseph goes off and he enslaves the entire Egyptian people when he doesn't need to. He plays chess with his brother's emotions. He turns into a dreadful character. And if you look at him against the politics of the time, you can argue that what he is doing is inappropriately cozying up to an empire, an evil empire, and getting far too involved in the power politics of another empire, with the result that, as it tends to do with trauma, things turn upside down. And so the people who are being enslaved by one group themselves find themselves being enslaved by another. So this is part of the reason why I was interested in Jacob's favoritism, is that you can see it play it out on the fate of Joseph. You can see it play out on the fate of the Egyptian people, and then you see it play out in the fate of the Israelites.
I need to make mention of a book here that I just read that is a bit of a controversial mention, but I've just read Mary Trump's book about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And it is it is biblical in terms of it is father's favoritism, it is rejection of the older son for not being strong on a whole lot of things, and it's the sort of dysfunction, and it is trauma actually that went on in that family according to her, and it's playing out globally.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and that's what you get. Yeah.
I mean, it is epic.
Yeah.
It's epic and yet ordinary. There's this paradoxical thing about these Bible narratives and these generations. They're both ordinary and epic and around us, yeah.
And they are both personal and political, and they're individual and they're nations.
Mm.
So each of the characters of this story is representing a tribe or a nation.
Mm.
And the whole question of this whole Joseph saga is, who is going to win? Who is going to be A, the chosen son, and B, the chosen nation?
Mm.
And it starts out looking very much like it's going to be Joseph, but it winds up being Judah and the South. So you've got these different levels of things going on the whole time. And this is something that the stories of Genesis do really effectively. And so one of the things, we don't see it in this story at all, there are, the women don't take particularly important roles except to have babies, which is very important. But the use of women in Genesis is really extraordinary because they are kind of adopted as characters who can go under the radar and do extraordinary and extraordinarily politically subversive things without anybody noticing, because this is just a domestic story, isn't it?
I'm reminded of the Hebrew midwives when you talk like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and we'll get to them in a few weeks.
We will, and
Moses.
There's many more examples.
Yes,
but
you will. Yeah. You will. Yeah.
We probably need to turn our minds to Matthew, but thank you. I think you've drawn out lots of themes for people to play with, and we're going to hear more from Meg Warner
next
in the
week,
next episode where we'll pick up again in the Joseph story. But Matthew 14 is our gospel reading, verses 22 to 33, known perhaps as the Jesus walking on water story. Fran, do you want to, any exegetically or thematic interesting points that you noticed?
Well, not particularly sort of original in that we've been having a conversation about Matthew for some months, of course, now, but just the references to Moses that are implicit again in verse 23 and on, going up the mountain and so on, echoing Exodus 32 where Moses seeks forgiveness for the people's idolatry. I would note probably verse 26 that the disciples were terrified when they saw him, not amazed or, you know, they were fearful, which is an interesting term. Why were they not just, wow, that's amazing, what a fantastic trick. But that something about it made them fearful. They thought he was a ghost. And the, again, echoing the Moses narrative with Jesus' self-identification, take heart, it is I, echoing I will be who I will be. Which God says from the burning bush to Moses.
Yeah, and of course, if you haven't been listening to us, I mean, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is a kind of new Moses. Mm. There's lots of ways that he embodies Moses, the lawgiver or teacher of the law, and then these mountain moments and everything you've just said.
Mm. Absolutely. And Matthew is the most Jewish of the gospels, almost Hebrew of the gospels, and that comes through in that characterization. And then, things like, I am who I am. Absolutely.
So there's a level here coming into the story where, of course, we can see echo what's being said here is the power of God to create order out of chaos, because the water represents and the storm is chaos, echoing Genesis 1. And Jesus is able to still it and walk on it unaffected.
Yeah, and that really struck me rereading this, how apocalyptic this story is. And Matthew is also quite apocalyptic in that sort of Jewish sense. He has earthquakes at significant moments. Mm. You know, the cosmos is shaken up by Jesus because Jesus is the presence of God. And so I think, again, I mean, this is just goes to show yet again why you have to know your Old Testament to read the New Testament, because
you
miss these echoes. I mean, that Genesis 1 creation is about ordering of chaos, and here Jesus shows himself to be that same God who can order the chaos of wind and waves that threaten life. And I think there's, you could focus on Peter here, or you could focus on Jesus, or you could do a bit of both. I think the focus on Jesus for me makes this almost an epiphany story, a bit like the Transfiguration. We're getting a glimpse of Jesus.
The revelation.
In that sense of, an epiphany being a vision or a revelation of a divine being or someone's deity. And we're seeing here Jesus in his sort of, it's a false dichotomy to switch between human and divine neatly, but, you know, Jesus' divinity being revealed as the I am, the one who can command water and waves, or creation effectively, the one who saves. Peter cries out, save me, and he has saving power. And this takes us back to the start of Matthew's gospel with the Emmanuel, God with us, that this is God with us in this scene.
Jesus' divinity is also recognized here.
Yep.
It's not just presented, but it's recognized by the people around him.
Yes.
Just trying to remember whether that's happened before yet in Matthew's gospel.
Ooh, not perhaps quite this starkly.
No.
No.
I think, yeah, that's a good point.
The centurion will.
Yes.
The centurion will. Yeah.
Yeah, and others will, but I think I don't think in Matthew we've, you know, apart from us being told as readers in from the narrator's perspective, but to have it recognized. And hence the terror. I mean, terror and fear are.
Yeah, part and parcel of that epiphany, that revelatory experience.
Exactly the right response to seeing an epiphany of a deity, you know.
Yeah.
But Pete, we should talk about Peter too, because this story's in Mark and Matthew's followed a lot of Mark here, but he gives Peter some speaking lines that he doesn't have in Mark. So the getting out of the boat, the walk, and, you know, the verbs are past tense. He does actually manage to walk on water for a bit and then he starts sinking and cries out, save me.
I think one of the most interesting things about Peter here, and I don't know whether this happens in the other Gospels, I don't think so because he doesn't speak, but he actually asks, he requests to be commanded.
Yes, tell me to get out.
Tell me to. And I think that's where the pastoral point or theological point might be here, is that he requests to be commanded. He asks something of God, of Jesus, and it's given. So, yes, walk, but also Jesus gives him the resources and the wherewithal, which is his person, to do that thing.
So, but he can't do it without Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's something like he claims him or something, which enables him to do that thing, to obey the command. And I think what's happening here too is you see Peter has faith. He understands that faith is something to do with obedience here.
Yeah, and following.
And
going to meeting Jesus. Yeah. I think that's right because we often – tell this story as the story of Peter's failure because he sinks. But I don't know what true success or faith would look like except for what Peter's done. He's asked to be like, take me out of my comfort zone. He's done it. He's followed the command. He's cried out to be saved and he's been saved.
Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No.
But what happened was he became fearful. So he took his eyes metaphorically and actually from Jesus, from the one who commanded and grasped him metaphorically.
Yeah.
And he becomes fearful. So he starts fearing his own survival, whereas if he'd kept his eyes on the one who commanded him, he would know all he needed to know and he'd be able to.
Yeah, there's something to play with there that could even take us back into Genesis, although we don't have time to do that now, but about the way that fear can undermine the courage to, you know, live into one's ministry or calling.
Yeah. We could also take a step away from the individual to the ecclesial and talk about the church and the, you know, being the boat and being asked to step out. What does that mean for the church to be asked to ask to request to step out?
Yeah. Thank you. Any last words from either of you as we wrap up this episode?
I'm just interested to notice the links between trauma and fear in these two stories.
Yes. So a lot to play with there. One could actually bring them together.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Meg Warner, for being with us today, and we look forward to having you back next week.
Yes, thank
pleasure.
You. It's been
look
a good conversation. Thanks, Meg.
You've been listening to By the Well. Thanks for listening.